The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
The more the world changes, the more we find comfort in things that never change. This is Rabbi Daniel Lappin On Demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rabbi Daniel Lappin Show, where I, your rabbi, remind you that the more that things change, the more we need to depend on those things that never change. Thanks for being part of the show. I appreciate it as always. The website, rabbidaniellappin.com, as you well know. And, you know, I often speak of the early 60s as being the most convenient milestone to mark the beginning of the huge changes that have wrecked America. I speak about the birth control tablet coming on the market in 1962, and I speak about a number of things. But what I've never mentioned before is something that my good friend William Federer pointed out, and he's so right about this, is that there were speeches made in the early 60s that no public figure could ever make today. And there was a Democrat in the Florida legislature. His name was Herlong, Albert Herlong. And he read on in January 1963, he said that he wants to read into the public record a list of communist goals for America so that people should be ever vigilant against these things and should know that regardless of who ends up pushing these policies, even if they don't proudly declare themselves to be communists, everybody should be aware of exactly who they are. So there are seven of them. Listen to this. Eliminate prayer or any phase of religious expression in the schools on the grounds that it violates the principle of separation of church and state. That's right. The communists figured out this is what they have to do. Everyone who pushed for separation of church and state was careful to avoid labeling themselves communist. But thanks to Albert Herlong, Florida Democrat, we have now in the official record, these are the goals of the Communist Party in the United States. Number two, discredit American culture, discredit the family as an institution, encourage promiscuity and divorce. Fantastic. And number three, present homosexuality, degeneracy, and promiscuity as normal, natural, and healthy. Number four, infiltrate churches and replace revealed religion with social justice. Number five, discredit the Bible and emphasize the need for intellectual maturity, which does not need a religious crutch. Number six, control the schools. Use them as transmission belts for socialism and current communist propaganda. Number seven, soften the curriculum. Get control of teachers' associations. Put party line in textbooks. Control student newspapers. It's pretty good. This was 1963. Public record in the Florida legislature. How about a speech by Ronald Reagan in 1961? It was entitled, Ronald Reagan Speaks Out Against Socialized Medicine. And here are some quotes from that speech. Now, back in 1927, an American socialist, Norman Thomas, six times candidate for president on the Socialist Party ticket, said the American people would never vote for socialism. But he said, under the name of liberalism, the American people will adopt every fragment of the socialist program. One of the traditional methods of imposing statism or socialism on a people has always been by way of medicine. It's very easy to disguise a medical program as a humanitarian project. James Madison in 1788 said, "There are more instances of the abridgment of the freedom of the people by gradual and silent encroachment of those in power than by violent and sudden usurpations. We want no further encroachment on these individual liberties and freedoms. We do not want socialized medicine. If you don't reject this, I promise you, this program will pass and behind it will come other federal programs that will invade every area of freedom as we have known until one day we will awake to find that we have socialism. And you and I are going to spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it was once like in America when men were free. Just a couple of years, two or three years before Reagan's speech on socialized medicine, the head of the Soviet Union was Nikita Khrushchev, and he told a guy who was President Eisenhower's Secretary of Agriculture, his name was Ezra Taft Benson, "Your children's children will live under communism. You Americans are so gullible. No, you won't accept communism outright, but we'll keep feeding you small doses of socialism until you will finally wake up and find that you already have communism. We won't have to fight you. We will so weaken your economy until you fall like overripe fruit into our hands." Well, the Soviet Union, of course, is no more, but socialism is still very much alive, and the American economy has been severely hurt and damaged by socialism, and it's not been imposed by the Communist Party or imposed by Russia. It's been seductively inserted into our culture by the universities, by the social elite, by people who have bought into it as a moral system, replacing what used to serve as a bulwark against the seduction of socialism, and that was Judeo-Christian biblical thinking. Once that was tossed out, people became, well, fair game for this. You know, this past Wednesday, November 7th, the Bolshevik Revolution happened 100 years ago. It was November 1917. Now, of course, they hadn't yet adopted the modern calendar in Russia, so they called it October, but it was actually November the 7th, the Bolshevik Revolution, and here we are 100 years down the road. They haven't done too badly, I'm sorry to say. One would have thought that it would have been discredited, but the truth is that as long as you provide as an alternative only a vacuum, socialism will always thrive. It is only in the context of a moral and philosophical framework that stands reliable and internally coherent, such as a Judeo-Christian framework, that socialism can be defeated. It can never be pushed out by nothing. It can only be pushed out by something. And one of the big mistakes that we make here in the West is thinking that socialism or communism and capitalism are the opposites. Not true. Socialism provides an entire moral framework. Even its language speaks of socialism and the poor and those in need. Capitalism is a description of a free market economy. But a free market economy isn't a moral system. Capitalism needs an accompanying moral system, namely Judeo-Christian thinking, in order to thrive. If you strip away the moral system, capitalism will surrender to socialism. And I think we're kind of seeing that all happening right now. And I think it's just worth thinking about it. It's 100 years ago, the Bolshevik Revolution. And in that 100 years, how many people have been killed in the name of the left, in the name of socialism? Millions of Soviet citizens under Stalin, probably as many as 30 million. I think Robert Conquest says a little higher than that. Mao Zedong in China, again in the name of communism, 50 million of his, that's right, 50 million people. Adolf Hitler in World War II. But wait, you shriek. That was fascism. That was Nazism. That wasn't communism. That wasn't the left. Actually, yes, it was. Nazism is a creation of the left. That's why it was called National Socialism. That's what Nazi is a contraction of. So this is something that we really ought to devote a show to at some time in the near future, because people really do have to understand that communism and fascism and Nazism are not at opposite ends of the spectrum. They're both at the same end of the spectrum, robbing the freedom of humanity and seizing the power in the heartless core of government. At the other end of that spectrum is, that's right, Judeo-Christian Bible-based thinking. That is the spectrum line. The culture, the religion, the moral philosophy that built the West, and on the other side, the moral philosophy, namely socialism, that, well, it's come pretty close to destroying the left. That's really what it seems like. And not only that, talking of fascism, but this past Thursday night was the anniversary of Kristallnacht in Germany, right? Kristallnacht was the night, November the 9th and 10th, where in 1938, right, just a few months before the outbreak of war, when the German government made pretty clear what its plan was to bring terror to the people of Germany. This was an attack on Jews. Smart people saw the writing on the wall, and smart people who were not Jewish saw the writing on the wall and realized they had to get out. But Kristallnacht, a horrible, terrifying night. You know, imagine you were a young child, a teenager, and Kristallnacht takes place in the city you're living. It took place all across Germany and Austria. But try and imagine what's like. 30,000 Jewish men hauled off to concentration camps after people, jackbooted, uniformed thugs, break the door down of your house. And it was the beginning of the end, of course, and it was quite a shocking thing. But the anniversary of that was this past Thursday night. And why do I tell you all of this? Because the world, the free world, or the West, has faced many perils, and the most powerful perils it's faced have been the left, Nazism and communism. Which we saw in the 20th century and the tremendous damage it inflicted on the world. And it's now facing another one based on Islam. And here is where I think it's worthwhile remembering that we are looking at a culture war, a titanic struggle between the culture of the Quran and the twin civilizations of the Bible, Judaism and Christianity. Now, the people that seem to have the best handle on this are the Jews, the land of Israel. That's pretty much where we see this happening. We see success. We see the ability to cope. In other words, the peril Israel faces is so much more severe than anything that any other country faces. In terms of 5 million Jews surrounded by 100 million Arabs that are indoctrinated and subject to ceaseless, relentless propaganda about killing the Jews. And Israel not only functions, but I have to tell you, having just returned recently, the level of stress is much lower than in the United States. In terms of people walking around anywhere in Israel late at night, women walking safely, kids traveling around town entirely on their own, I noticed that the bus stop buttons, you know, the buttons in the bus in order to indicate to the driver you want to get off at the next stop, in Israel buses, they're down low because so many kids ride the buses themselves. It's a country that has managed to succeed. Now, we really do need to understand Israel a little bit better because we are not succeeding here. The indignity and outrage that the TSA inflicts on travelers every single day in the airports of the United States of America, we should be ashamed of ourselves for docilely allowing this aggressive assault on our freedoms. Israel doesn't do that. You can get on planes in Israel and you come eye to eye with a skilled airport security operative who asks you a few questions and then either sends you off to another room for main questioning or lets you continue. You don't have to strip. You don't have to. It's a different game because they understand the nature of the danger. In America, we think the danger is bullets and bombs. In Israel, they understand it's people and ideologies. And more than that, they've also understood that if you can cut off the blood flow of terror in the form of money, you are well on your way to succeeding. And sure enough, Israel for many years already has led the world in knowing how to strike at the terror financial network. Only now, for the first time, is a lot of this information released in a book that was published this past week called Harpoon, Inside the Covert War Against Terrorism's Money Masters. It's a fabulous book. It's a non-stop, cannot put it down, eyes bugging out of my head kind of read. It's by a woman, Nitzana Darshan Leitner, and the book is so amazing that I asked if I could interview her in order to let you all know about this book. She's in Israel, and I'll apologize in advance. Once again, the audio quality is not what I really would like for the interview, but nonetheless, here it comes. I know that you are going to enjoy it. Our website is rabbidaniellappin.com. And when you head over there, I want you to take a look at a resource called Clash of Destiny, Decoding the Secrets of Israel and Islam. And the reason I say that is because that is where we lay out the heart of this titanic struggle between the culture of the Quran and the twin civilizations of the Bible. And the reality of that, and the reality of the battle being waged every hour of every day in Israel, is, I think, what brings to life the drama of this book, Harpoon, and my interview with its author, Nitzana Darshan Leitner. Okay, so I hope you're going to enjoy it, and do let me know, would you? Because, as you know, it's very rare that I interview authors on this show, very rare that I recommend books, and I do recommend you all. I really think you should order this one. You won't be sorry. It's stuff you need to know about how terrorism is tackled effectively, and how we have made, particularly during the Obama years, terrible mistakes. Anyway, all of that coming right up as I talk to Nitzana. And do let me know at my website. Contact me through the website, rabbidaniellappin.com. I'd like to know if you enjoyed it, particularly if it was worth airing for you, given the less than perfect audio. Any rate, your rabbi, that's me. Let's get ready for the interview coming right up. Don't go away.
Ancient solutions to modern problems. This is Rabbi Daniel Lappin, on demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Rabbi Daniel Lappin, and Retirement Curveball is a book by a finance expert that I respect, Dr. Tom McPhee. Whether you are thinking about retirement, are already retired, or have never given the big R even a thought, now is the time to welcome the contents of this book into your mind. The book is filled with compelling aha moments and will motivate you to make some highly effective changes in how you manage your money and your life. I know Dr. Tom McPhee and his terrific book, Retirement Curveball, and I do recommend it. Get the book at retirementcurveball.com or on Amazon.
Rabbi Daniel Lappin returns with more of how the world really works on the Blaze Radio Network On Demand.
Welcome, everybody, and happy to have you back on the Rabbi Daniel Lappin Show, where I, your rabbi, reveal how the world really works. And in the earlier segment, I indicated to you that onwards in the show, I was going to have a real treat for you. Now, look, folks, how many times have you heard me interview anybody on this show? If you are a regular listener, I think you'll agree that it's like maybe once a year, occasionally a second time a year, but almost never do I have any guests on the show. And let me ask you something else. How many books have you heard me recommend? I quote from books in the show all the time. And I talk about books, but you remember I always say, you know what, you don't need to waste your money or your time buying that book because I'll be telling you all about it. It's very unusual. for me to tell you, you know what, this book belongs in your library. But today, it's true. I'm talking to the author of a book that does belong in your library. So I'm going to be very explicit. I'm going to tell you a few times during the broadcast. The name of the book is Harpoon, Inside the Covert War Against Terrorism's Money Masters. And the author is a remarkable woman, an Israeli woman called Nitzana Darshan Leitner. She's an Israeli. She's an activist, and she's also a lawyer. But she's also one of the leading lights of something called the Israel Law Center. It's called Shurat HaDin in Hebrew. The word din means law, and this is a fascinating organization, a fascinating woman, and an absolutely must-have book. Now, you know, you hear me saying so often that my job as your rabbi is to reveal how the world really works, that you hear it so often that you probably after a while begin to think of it as just a mindless slogan, but it isn't. And that's why it is that we talk about on this show things that really matter, things you care about, things that reveal how the world really works. And that's why, although we use a lens of ancient Jewish wisdom, the fact is what we're talking about are things that impact your lives. We're talking about sex and marriage. We're talking about money. We're talking about things that really count. And occasionally we'll talk about politics as well. But as you know, that's not really the central theme of the show, because who cares, right? A lot of the time, nobody even cares about the politics. But you're going to care about this, because we all care about life and death. We all care about the cultural war going on that has been going on for a long time. And I don't know that my guest necessarily will agree how I phrase things, and she'll have an opportunity to phrase them her own way in a few moments. But to me, a titanic cultural war between the forces of Islam coupled with the forces of secular liberalism as found on the American University campus and elsewhere against the culture and the civilizations created by Judeo-Christian thinking, Western thought, chiefly manifested today by Israel and the United States of America. You've heard me often talk about the alliance of destiny, and that alliance is between Washington and Jerusalem. And I believe it was temporarily interrupted by 8 years of Obama, but I think it's back alive, perhaps better than it ever was before. And so it could hardly be a more wonderful time for this book to be released. And it is just being released now. This is really cutting-edge news. And I'm going to keep telling you the name of the book, because I do seriously want you to go ahead and get hold of it. It will open your eyes. Why? Well, the way the world really works is, you know, life and death are paramount, obviously. We're all excited when a child is born in our neighborhood or in our community or in our families. When a couple gets married, that speaks of new life and the vitality of an ongoing culture, family, civilization. And then, of course, we react appropriately with death. I mean, that's the essence of life. And so when terror has become a way of life to such an extent that the mayor of London can say, well, I guess that's just the price of civilization. We've just got to learn to live with it. Well, maybe that's good for the mayor of London, but it isn't any good for the folks in Israel. And as you all know, I just got back from Israel 2 weeks ago. I usually try and write a new book there once a year. I try and spend 4 or 5 weeks there. And terror in Israel is a really serious problem. Number one, because the country is very, very close. People know one another and are connected with one another. It's a very small country. The population is small. And it can't function. The lifeblood of the country collapses when fear rules the streets. And so terror is an incredibly potent force to use against Israel. Not surprisingly, nobody has got a better handle on dealing with terrorism than Israel. Now, before I introduce my guest, I just want to say that that the aviation industry is a really good example of the difference between the way America and the rest of the world handles things and the way Israel does. Israel is very different. In the United States and the rest of the world, the concern begins when the bad guy arrives in the airport. And that's when they start trying to figure out who it is. And they are handicapped by all kinds of politically correct regulations that don't allow them to use intelligence. What they're hoping to use is really low-level employees conducting a mechanized system which is somehow going to stop the terrorist. In Israel, it works very differently. Their focus is on stopping the terrorist long before he gets to the airport. Long before he purchases his equipment, and long before the plot is even finally concocted. That's the huge difference. And one of the ways this is accomplished is by being aware that, like everyone else in the real world, money is needed by terrorists. And that begins to bring us to our guest, Nitzana Darshan Leitner. Thank you very much indeed. I appreciate you making the time. I know it's been difficult for me to be able to get a hold of you. You are appropriately busy, but I did want to share your story with my audience.
Thank you very much, Rabbi, for having me. It's a real pleasure.
I had hoped to meet you while I was in Israel, but as you know, that unfortunately didn't work out. But God willing, sometime in the future, I would very much like to greet you in person and thank you for this incredible book. Let's, if you don't mind, let's just dive in. The basic concept, and we're going to fill it out as we move along, but the basic concept that you developed along with the head of the Israel Mossad, Meir Dagan, right?
Right.
The concept was that that instead of waiting till they strike, track the money, find how they're financing everything, track that, and use the tools available of any kind in order to handicap their capacity to function financially. Because in the modern world, yes, even terrorists who blow themselves up with primitive bombs, somebody needed to finance that. Money needed to flow. And so we'll talk about where the money comes from and how it gets to them. But let's dive into one of the most dramatic episodes that you know a great deal about. What I'm talking about is an episode that took place, I think it was in January 2010. And it took place in Dubai, in a hotel room, where a guy called Mahmoud Al-Mabou, who obviously played a huge role in funding terror and organizing terror, checked into his hotel room in Dubai, and a team of about 25 individuals managed to get into his hotel room, inject him with a muscle relaxant, suffocate him, assassinate him, and get out of the country before anyone even discovered his body. Subsequently, the police chief in Dubai insisted that he was 99% sure that this was the work of the Mossad, the Israeli Mossad, and then he corrected himself a little while later and said he's 100% sure. All right, that's the story that most of us remember, and that's about all we know. But you know a whole lot more. Fill us in.
Well, the guy was the money man of Hamas. He was very well connected. He was living in Syria, and he was gathering money for Hamas to fund their terror activity. The money usually was coming from Iran or from Qatar. to deliver the money into the West Bank, he needed to go to a meeting point, which usually was in the Persian Gulf, mainly Dubai. Dubai is a very lucrative, very fancy city. This guy, Mabhouh, liked going to this city to enjoy the beauty of it. So one day he went to Dubai for his meeting to receive the funds Hamas so desperately needed in the West Bank and Gaza. And some other Israeli agents, this is according to foreign press, obviously, were following him into the country. They didn't know in which hotel he'll be staying, and they spread all over a couple of hotels that they thought he might go into. Finally, they tracked him in one of the hotels. They followed him from the desk to his room and saw which room he was staying. They went back to the desk and rented the room across the hall. And at nighttime, they were able and managed to get into his room and to inject him with this with this stuff. Actually, it wasn't an injection. It was just a heart attack that they caused him to have as a result of a pillow on his face. They managed to make it so clean that they put him in the bed, cover him with a blanket, and make it look like he's sleeping. Then what's amazing was that they were able to get out of the room and bolt and lock it from outside. And after a couple of hours, already they were on the planes, on the flights, back to where they came from. Some came from New Zealand, some came from Europe, some came from Australia, some came from Britain, and some came from Israel.
Now, of course, we're absolutely not saying that Israel committed this assassination. We're only saying that Dubai says that Israel was behind it. But we're just telling you what happened. That's all.
And, well, Israel never admitted that they were not behind the assassination. Yes. But they weren't sorry for the guy to be disappeared.
Of course not. Now, explain why it was so important for this guy to be terminated.
You see, this was unique in this new frontier on the war against their financing. Israel was the first one to realize that money drives everything, including terror attacks. Without money, terrorism cannot be carried out. Terror organizations cannot function. They need money and a lot of it. So back then, in the end of the 90s, the former head of the Mossad, Meir Dagan, decided that there is a need for a special force in the Israeli intelligence forces to go after money, after terror money. And he launched this unit called Harpoon. It was contained soldiers, spies, agents, but also worked with lawyers, accountants, and hackers. And they have one goal: to go after the money. They have one directive: follow the money, target the money, kill the money. Money was the oxygen to the terror organizations, and they were determined to choke it off. So for the first time, money men became a target. Money men were the one who were behind the attacks, that without them, the attacks would not be carried on. And therefore, even if you were only a finance guy in the terror organization, if you were only the bagman, if you're only a deputy that dealt with banks, you became a target, a very high-value target, perhaps the highest value of them all. And Mabhouh happened to be one of them.
Now, the so-called territories or the West Bank, cities like Ramla, for instance, it's a huge, sprawling city. I never even understood until I'd actually been there what an absolute rabbit's warren it is of roads and lanes and alleys and buildings and tunnels. And it's in that area that a lot of this is organized, that a lot of the terror is plotted and planned. And it's also there where a lot of the financial structure is, right? So there are Arab banks throughout the area, I presume, through which a lot of this money flows, right?
Right, absolutely. The we call it West Bank, Judean Samaria, where I'm going to go into who owns what. At the moment, we all understand what our right to the country is, but Ramallah and Nablus and Hebron and many, many cities in the West Bank have banks, have post offices, have schools, have hospitals, and have banks. And the banks are usually Jordanian banks, Egyptian banks, not Israeli banks, and not international banks, but only from these countries, and Palestinian banks. And the population in the West Bank and also in Gaza count on these banks. This is where they save the money. This is where they take loans. This is where they get their salary paid. It's all in the banking system. Now, but along with them, the terror organizations in these areas using the banks as well.
What is so delicate here is that Israel has to destroy the financial foundation of terror, but at the same time, what you don't want to do is damage the ability of the ordinary people trying to earn a living and get through their day. You don't want to destroy their ability to function.
So when Israel wanted to confiscate the money that belongs to the terror organizations, which is held in different accounts in the banks, they did not go and destroy the banks, as they did, by the way, several years later in Lebanon, when they destroyed the banks that had bank accounts for Hezbollah.
Yes.
They simply went and raided the banks. They took troops of soldiers and tanks and surrounded the banks, each and every bank in the West Bank. And the commander went into the bank, met with the manager of the bank, showed him pieces of papers where indication of how money in the different accounts that his bank holds belong to Hamas or Islamic Jihad, and went with the bank manager to the safe and took the money in cash from the safe that belonged according to the account that he had, and gave the bank manager a receipt.
Right. Well, quick break, and when we come back, I want to try and ask you to track the money for us. In other words, where does it start from its journey? And one of the questions touches on some. I just got back last night from Dallas, Texas, and in the suburbs of Dallas is a town called Richardson. And in Richardson is the notorious Holy Land Foundation. And love to get a little bit more of a picture from you of how money flows all the way from there, all the way through the system, the terrorist system, to the hands, the blood money, the hands of the terrorist and to their families, which, again, this has not yet stopped, that funding goes to the families of people who blow themselves up in acts of terror. Let's do that coming right back. I'm Rabbi Daniel Lapin. The website, as you know, is rabbidaniellapin.com. And that's the place to contact me, send me emails. That's the place to subscribe to our mailing lists. And it is, of course, the place in which you can find considerably more information on anything we're talking about on the show, as well as resources that we've prepared for you. All of that at rabbidaniellapin.com. A quick break, and we will be right back with Nitzana Darsha Leitner, Nitzana is the author of a fantastic book called Harpoon, H-A-R-P-O-O-N, right? Harpoon, because what they're doing is they're trying to harpoon this enormous monster of international Islamic terror. Following the money as soon as we get back, okay? I'm Rabbi Daniel Lappin, back with you in a moment.
You're listening to Rabbi Daniel Lappin on demand on the Blaze Radio Network. Find more at theblaze.com/radio. Revealing how the world really works. This is Rabbi Daniel Lappin on demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
Okay, welcome back, everybody. Your rabbi, Rabbi Daniel Lappin, solemnly dedicated to revealing how the world really works. And as you know, the more that things change, the more we have to depend on those things that never change. And one of those things that never changes is the role of money. And as you know, unlike many cultures in which money is regarded as somehow evil and poverty is venerated as a mark of virtue, in Jewish tradition, nothing could be further from the truth. We have a great deal of respect for money because we understand the role that it plays in how the world really works. And I'm afraid that the frightening and horrible world of terror is no different. And Israel is light years ahead of the rest of the world in understanding that if you want to attack terror, yes, you need guys in ballistic armor with guns, and you need undercover spies, and you need commandos, and you need bombs, all of those things, unfortunately, absolutely vital. But you also need accountants and forensics, financial specialists, and you need to be able to track the blood supply of terror, which is money. And nobody knows more about that than Nitzana Darshan Leitner, who is an Israeli attorney and at the heart of something called the Israel Law Center. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But the key thing is that she's brought all this now to you in a book called Harpoon. And you don't hear me recommending books. I talk about books a lot, but how often do you hear me telling you you need to buy a book? Very rarely, right? Run, do not walk to the bookstore. The book is called Harpoon, and it was actually published, I believe, just the day before I am conducting this interview with Nitzana. That's right, Nitzana, isn't it? It was published just yesterday, I think.
Yeah, it was yesterday, yes.
Yeah, so I thought so. So, I mean, this may be the very first interview you've done on the book.
One of the first ones.
One of the first. Well, you sound great. So you sound as if you've been doing this for years, which probably has something to do with your work.
Yeah, when as a lawyer, you have to argue before judges. You have to give speeches. I'm pretty
well. Our audience is much friendlier than any judge or any courtroom.
I'm glad.
we want to hear you. Okay, so there I am in Richardson, Texas, the home of the Holy Land Foundation, and the Holy Land Foundation raises money to help the widows and orphans on the West Bank. How bad can this be?
Well, all this money... Go ahead, I'm sorry, Rabbi.
No, over to you.
Yeah, this money that the Holy Land Foundation was raising was going to the Hamas organization in the West Bank in Gaza. They were giving millions of dollars that were raised from the Muslim community in these areas in the United States. But this money is going to a terror organization. And the terror organization does not distinguish between giving charity to the families or using the money for its military purposes. But the situation was that this money actually fueled the flames behind the terror organizations. Also, this money was given to the families that lost their loved ones in the jihadi attacks against Israel, the families of the suicide bombers, the families of the prisoners of the terrorists that now imprisoned in Israeli jail and sitting there for many years. So this whole operation literally held the Hamas organization in the West Bank and Gaza. That was many, many years ago. In addition to this, add the money that was flown to the Palestinian Authority when it was just established. Remember, the European Union promised to help the Palestinian Authority to get established and committed to pay them $10 million a month. And don't think even for a moment that this money that was intended to go and help the population really went to build hospitals or schools or pave roads. It was literally...
If $10 million a month had been spent in some of the areas that I've seen in Nablus and in Hebron and in Ramallah and also in Gaza, if $10 million a month was being spent on infrastructure, there'd be something to show for it. And what is more, we'd find that Arabs wouldn't be preferring to come to Israeli hospitals. There'd be enough hospitals for them to attend there. So we know that that's not happening.
Right.
The money, in fact, was funneled predominantly into building an infrastructure of terror. Is that right?
Yeah. Yasser Arafat, that controlled the Palestinian Authority for at least 10, 11 years, were stealing the money, using it as his own private money, and diverting a lot of it to terrorism. He was awarding terrorists. He was paying the families of the terrorists. He was paying the prisoners. He was purchasing arms. He was smuggling boats full of arms into the West Bank, into Gaza.
Now, how did the special military unit, Harpoon, which is also the name of your book, how did they get so much money out of Arafat's account?
Well, that's a hilarious story. In the second intifada, it was clear that Arafat was using this money for terrorism. And Mayor Dagan went to the prime minister back there, was Ariel Sharon, and asked him what to do. And Ariel Sharon wasn't fond of Yasser Arafat. He refused even to shake his hand. So he gave Mayor Dagan instructions and told him, why don't you separate Arafat from his money? The Harpoon unit agents went to a country in South America, opened an investment fund over there, and invited Muhammad Rashid, who was the financial advisor of Yasser Arafat, to come and watch this investment company. This investment fund showed him how lucrative the profits he can get from this investment, what high interest this it bears. They even showed him what personal interest, personal profit he will get if he invests money in this fund. And Muhammad Rashid was excited. So he invested a lot of Arafat's money into this investment fund. And indeed, after a short while, he got very high interest on his money. And he did not pull the money out, but invested more and more. And he got really lucrative profits in return on his money. Until one day, he called the company up, and nobody answered the phone. He went to South America to check the investment company, and the company simply disappeared, along with Arafat's money. Right. Talking about hundreds of millions of dollars that Arafat did not have as a result of this con game.
Money that obviously would have been used to kill Westerners.
Yes, it was served for good purposes later on.
Yes, I'm sure it was. And now there is one of the challenges, and you describe this beautifully in the book, and I'd love you to just give a little bit of a flavor of it for our listeners, is that you're treading very delicately all along, because a majority of the population of Jordan is Palestinian now, and there is a sort of a relationship between Jordan and Israel. Royal Jordanian Airlines flies into Ben-Gurion Airport. Israeli airlines fly from Ben Gurion Airport into Amman. There's something of a relationship. So you've got a challenge now. Harpoon had a problem, which is they've got to do something about these banks. They've got to do something about the financial network that underpins terror. But how do they do that without upsetting the King of Jordan?
Yeah, this was really hard. They went and talked in the beginning to people in the Jordanian government, because the banks in the West Bank were controlled by the Jordanian government. They all were Jordanian banks. The Arab Bank, which was the major bank in the West Bank, through its hundreds of millions of dollars were going to the terror organizations and the families of the suicide bombers, was a Jordanian bank, was owned by the Jordanian kingdom. And therefore, they after they raided the banks, which created a whole catastrophe through the American government, were absolutely unpleased from this situation. Mayor Dagan decided to provide the information that
he
got.
Just to remind everybody, Mayor Dagan was the head of the Israeli Mossad. So when Nitzan speaks about Mayor Dagan, that's who it is.
Absolutely. Thank you, Rabbi. And he decided to give all this information to private lawyers that perhaps can go and use it for their litigation against the terror organizations and those countries that support them. And at the time, there were a lot of lawsuits that we filed against, we in Shurat Adin, filed against the Hamas, against Islamic Jihad, against Iran, against Syria, against banks that provide them with financial services. And these documents were very important to show as evidence in the courtrooms. And eventually, these cases ended in a way, but sent a shockwave through the international banking system. We didn't even have to wait until the cases were over for the banks to change the way they're doing businesses. The banks immediately learned their lesson, to the extent that no bank agreed anymore to open bank account to a designated organization. No bank agreed to provide financial services to an Islamic charity, right, like the Holy Land Foundation that identifies with terror organization. And no bank agreed to operate in terror zones like South Lebanon, like Gaza. And there is no banking system in these places anymore, which makes difficulties, tremendous difficulties, to the terror organization that control these areas.
Nitzana, let me just ask you this, by the way. This is a fabulous story. It's an absolutely fantastic story. The name of your book is called Harpoon: Inside the Covert War Against Terrorism's Money Masters. And it's an unbelievably exciting read. Believe me, I assure you, you're going to pick this book up, and it's one of those one-reading books. Your spouse is going to be asking you at 1 o'clock in the morning, when are you going to sleep, because you're still going to be reading Harpoon. At least that's what happened to Susan and me, I'll tell you that. But a question, Nitzana, can we go one more segment, or are you pushed for time?
We can do a short one.
Okay, then we're going to do a quick break, and we're going to come back, and I'm going to ask you about social media, because who on earth thinks that social media is part of the war against terrorism or part of the conducting of terrorism? But you were among the people who did recognize this, and I'm going to want to just get a little more of a picture on that. The author of Harpoon, Nitzana Darshan Leitner, with me here on the Rabbi Daniel Lapin Show. Our website is rabbidaniellapin.com, and right there you will find a resource that we prepared for you called Clash of Destiny, Decoding the Secrets of Israel and Islam. That is at RabbiDanielLappin.com, along with an opportunity to subscribe to Thought Tools, which you get every week. So head on over to RabbiDanielLappin.com and do what you know you have to do. I'll be back with you in just a moment together with our guest. Don't go away.
There's still more to come from Rabbi Daniel Lappin on demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
The Morning Blaze with Doc Thompson.
Well, most Americans, even conservatives, have this failure. They know their rights. They even know rights they don't have. I know my rights. They'll talk about the government must do this for me. But they fail to know their responsibility, to take accountability for their actions, not society's, for their actions. And if you do, then society as a whole will not have the breakdown we have been experiencing.
The Morning Blaze, weekday morning, 6 to 9 Eastern, on the Blaze Radio Network.
With stories in the areas of family, friendship, faith, and finance, this is Rabbi Daniel Lappin. Only on the Blaze Radio Network On Demand.
Okay, everybody, we're back for one final segment with the author of a fabulous book. It's a must-read book. You need to order it right away. It's called Harpoon. Honestly, you don't hear me saying that very often. I've been stressing it during the show just because I do want you to remember that this is not a huckster-type show. I'm not constantly telling you this book is the best thing you've ever read or that book's the best thing you've ever read or you've got to go along and listen. You know, here's an author. I think this might be the second author I've interviewed in the last 2 years, honestly. So I really don't do this often. I only do it when I know that you're not going to say to me afterwards, why did you tell us to buy that book? But you're going to say, thank you for recommending that book. This book is one of those. It's called Harpoon, the Inside the Covert War Against Terrorism's Money Masters. And the book's got everything, by the way. I mean, it's cloak and dagger, it's behind the scenes, it's tough guys, very, very tough guys, tough women, smart men and women, and it gives you a glimpse, really a glimpse into how Israel operates. I mean, because when you think about it, isn't it a miracle? 70 years of this they've put up with now. For 70 years, since their founding in 1948, the next year we'll be celebrating the 70th birthday of Israel. For 70 years, they've been surrounded by people 20 times their population and more. That's just the contiguous neighbors who are trying to terminate their existence. People who, in exchange for all the riches of the world, will not grant Israel the right to exist. That's what you're dealing with. Right? I mean, have you any idea of what it would be like if Canada and Mexico were both dedicated to the destruction of the United States? Well, it's a whole lot worse because of the disparity in population and size and wealth between the Islamic world and the state of Israel. How does Israel survive? Well, you know me already. I think a good part of the answer is a miracle. But God works miracles through amazing people very often, if not all the time. And some of the amazing people are the topic of this book by my guest, Nitzana Darshan-Leitner. The book is Harpoon, and it really will fill you with a sense of amazement at what this tiny little country manages to pull off every day. And you'll thrill to some of these stories. It'll blow your mind, absolutely blow your mind. And Nitzana, thanks so much for being on the show. I'm just thrilled that we have an opportunity to chat for a few minutes. And one of the sort of hidushim, we call it in Hebrew, one of the insights, one of the new ideas that had to be brought home to a reluctant world was that terrorism isn't only about bombs and bullets, it's also about dollars and yen and dinars and all kinds of currencies. In other words, money is as much of a part of the war on terror as are bullets and bombs. That's part of the story of this book, and it's absolutely fascinating. But what sent a shiver down my spine
was that what you also say is, you kind of say, and you'll correct me if I don't have this exactly right, but what I took away from it was you said, well, today everyone is now finally beginning to realize that money is part of the war on terror. Tomorrow they are going to discover that social media is part of it as well. If I have that right, what do you mean?
Yeah, you have it absolutely right, Rabbi. We live in a time that the social media is in every house. Everybody's using it, including the terrorists. We live in a time that you will find thousands of posts calling to kill, in our case, Jews. Pages named Stab the Jews. Videos illustrating how to stab, how to twist the knife, where exactly to slaughter the Jew, diagram of human's body, what to do. And all the terrorists that are involved in recent terror attacks in recent years have Facebook page, and they get posts that inciting them to go and kill. They themselves brag that they are going to become Shahid. And after they go and stab, you'll find tens of thousands of posts endorsing their act, glorifying it, encouraging others to follow them. So there is no question that the, our case, the social media, Facebook, become a tool in the hands of the terror organizations, to the extent that Prime Minister Netanyahu called this recent wave of terrorism in Israel the Facebook Intifada. The terror organizations are using the social media as a platform for everything they do. And if we're talking about Hamas, it's no different than ISIS. ISIS is using the Google platform, YouTube, to deliver their messages, to send these beheading videos, which in the end inciting and encouraging people from all over the world to join them, showing them what they can do, what they can benefit. Otherwise, how people from Austria, from Switzerland can know about ISIS, know to go all the way to Turkey, cross the border to Iraq and Syria and join the military forces over there. So the new front of the terrorism is in the social media. They're using the social media to recruit militants, to raise funds. Hezbollah just recently launched a crowdsourcing campaign on Facebook, something it was able never to do in any other platform. They're using it to spread their ideology, spread their propaganda, and as a result of it, people getting killed. Every terror attack that happened recently, talking about the past 2 to 3 years, started in the social media. And this is the new front. This is what the intelligence forces in Israel and in Western countries have to fight next.
What do you think? What do you think that America most needs to understand? What is the one thing that America doesn't get? The most important thing that this country doesn't understand or doesn't get?
What America doesn't understand? America has a law. It's called Communication Decency Act. It's a law that grants blanket immunity to the social media networks. And it was a good law. You know, Congress wanted to keep the internet open and it could not find every social media network liable for content that users are posting on their pages. So they grant blanket immunity to these social media networks. But the social media giants are using this immunity. And they're letting the terror organization use them as any other tool in their war, because they say we are not getting involved, we are immune, we cannot be responsible or accountable for anything that goes on. And quite frankly, our business model is to keep it open, to keep it this way, to encourage everyone from any kind and sort to use our platform. The American administration has to understand that this has to stop, that they have to find ways to limit the social media networks. We already hear voices coming up from Europe to this on this issue. Prime Minister of Britain Theresa May already say that if the social media networks, meaning Twitter, Google, YouTube, will not change their policy and will not limit posts of terrorism and videos of terrorism on their platform, they will have to regulate them. Same thing came out from the Foreign Ministry of the European Union, because they understand that this post caused people to go and kill. They connect between each other. They connect between those who incite to kill to those who finally go and do it. They teach people how to create explosives, how to create a bomb, what exactly they need to do in order to go and run over pedestrians in a mall. It's a devastating tool. And the American who owns the internet, and I say it in a ridiculous manner, but what can you do? ICANN and the Ministry of Industry own the internet, have to limit these social media networks. Otherwise, it will create more and bigger disaster.
You know, things change, and it's very, very hard to bring about change. They say that one of the reasons that the Israelites had to stay in the desert for 40 years was because you cannot introduce freedom to a people who have slavery still implanted in their hearts. The whole generation had to die. And the same is true in the world of science, where scientific ideas like the old model of the atom, it took years and years and years before the true model was accepted, because all the people who were deeply invested in the old model basically had to die before the world was ready for the new one. In America, there's certain implanted ideas, hostility to censorship, freedom of expression, etc., etc., etc. What we're talking about here is that some of this may have to be curtailed. At least the discussion is going to have to be held in order to prevent something far worse, which is a force that is absolutely intent on the end of America and on the end of Israel. But when we talk about regulating social media, no American feels comfortable about it. But I think we all feel a lot less comfortable about being blown up.
More to come from Rabbi Daniel Lapin, revealing how the world really works. On demand on the Blaze Radio Network. The Glenn Beck Program.
Do you see anybody sitting down and saying, okay, wait a minute. All right, let's look at history. Let's really look at history. Let's have this conversation. Is this your priority? We're so free of problems that we can sit down and say, you know, that statue in the park, let's get down to that. We're so free of problems that that's what we're spending our time on. Wow.
The Glenn Beck Program. Welcome back to Rabbi Daniel Lapin On Demand, only on the Blaze Radio Network.
Exactly. There is a balance between freedom of speech, between the freedom of the internet, something the American endured, to the right to live safely, with your life being protected, and that nobody will attack you as a result of incitement that they observed in the social media. It's right now in the courts. We have several lawsuits going on against Google, YouTube, and Twitter and Facebook on behalf of terror victims. Some terror victims from Israel that were killed or injured by Hamas. Some victims from Paris attack and Brussels attack, victims of ISIS, all have the same allegation that the social media allowed the terror organizations to use them as platform and therefore violates an American law which prohibits American companies to provide any sort of services to a designated terror organization, any type of support, any type of material support of services. This is aiding and abetting terrorism. And since these social media networks know that these organizations are using their platform, they're doing it actually intentionally and knowingly. And therefore, they are liable and they are responsible and carry civil and criminal liability for these victims. So we have cases going on in the Federal District Court of New York and California for billions of dollars against these social media giants being litigated. And indeed, the major question is, what would govern? What will rule? What would be the end result? It will go all the way to the Supreme Court because it's a very hard and constitutional issue to deal with. What should be it? The freedom of speech, freedom of the internet, or the right of the people to live safely in their land?
And the your organization, Shurat HaDin, the Israel Law Center, is engaged in precisely this kind of lawsuit. As an attorney, I mean, do you have a feel for what the chances are of these plaintiffs prevailing against the social media giants?
Well, we believe that we can win the cases. We believe that in the end, the court will find the social media networks responsible, accountable, because in the end, social media have sexual responsibility. They cannot just let these words kill innocent people. But I also believe that the legal process is important, because I truly expect the directors and the owners of these social media networks to go and change their policy even before the cases will end. Before the cases will come to an end, they will realize that it's not worth their while to continue and support the terror organizations, even if they're doing it unintentionally. If they really didn't mean that, they will find the algorithm, they will find the tools to change their policy, to track this incitement and to take it down, because it's not worth having billions of dollars in damages eventually ruled against you. And it's not worth having judgments on behalf of terror victims claiming that you are aiding and abetting the terrorism.
So we really are going to be seeing very major changes in how things function, and social media is part of that. I know that we are running out of time, and it's very, very late for you, and you've been so busy, and you've been so not only kind, but you've sounded wonderful. You sound fresh and passionate, and the book is like that. Folks, the second book, it is literally the second book I've recommended you purchase in the last 2 years. So it's called Harpoon. Pop right onto your computers, head over to Amazon or Barnes & Noble, or wherever you like you're buying your books. Books Harpoon, Inside the Covert War Against Terrorism's Money Masters. It'll excite you, you won't be able to put it down, but it'll also inspire you. And it'll also widen your horizons, understanding how the world really does work. And I hate letting you go, so I've got to ask you this. We always think about the terror nexus as being Israel and the United States. And yes, we've seen horrible stuff going on in Sweden and in the United Kingdom, and obviously in France. And it's always Islamic terror. But you alarmed me in the book where you mention countries like Canada and Venezuela. Just give us a quick, like, what have they got to do with all of this?
These are places that Hezbollah or other terror organizations find very comfortable to work, to go and work and to go and act and to go and operate. Hezbollah runs its trafficking, drug trafficking campaigns in Venezuela, in South America, even in places in Africa, places that have no rule, that nothing governs there, open widely to a terror organization to go and operate. And in Canada, it's being used by Hezbollah for their financial infrastructure. It's not as wild as South America, but yet Hezbollah have very long and deep ties in Canadian land. And you know, it depends on the government, depends if the government designates Hezbollah and it fights it. And it very much depends on the community as well, if the population in Canada is Muslim extremists or a lot of immigrants, tens of thousands of immigrants that are coming from Syria, coming from Lebanon, coming from Iraq, coming in places that endorse Hezbollah, the government will act accordingly. So we'll really hope that these countries will understand that terrorism will not escape their land as it didn't escape United States and European countries, and hopefully we'll start taking steps to eliminate the terrorism from their land as well.
One last question. Can we do one last one?
One last one.
All right. When I spoke in a church in Dallas this last Sunday, somebody came up to me afterwards and spoke about tremendous problems that he's having with his daughter. She's away at college, and I discussed a little bit, and then I said, but wait a second, let me understand. She's living in an apartment, and she's paying tuition. Where's she getting the money to do that? And he said, well, you know, my wife and I give her, and he spoke about a fairly large sum every month. And I said, well, then I really don't understand. If you're paying the bills, why can't you turn off that tap? I mean, she's violating everything you believe in. Why are you continuing to fund it? He said, I've never thought about that. He said, it sort of feels a little bit wrong to use money as a tool. Well, terrorists use money as a tool, obviously, but money is a reality, absolutely, very much a reality. So we started off the interview with a very exciting story about the assassination of Mahmoud al-Mabou in Dubai, and obviously Dubai and probably the rest of the world too thinks that the Israeli Mossad did it. Let's say whoever did it knew exactly what they were doing and they pulled off an absolutely flawless job, but we don't know really who it is. Let's finish off with another exciting story. And one of the many, many exciting stories in your outstanding book is how 3 years ago when Gaza was shooting rockets all over Israel and sending killers through tunnels into Israeli settlements, one of the things that Israel did was they managed to destroy a huge sum of cash that was on its way to be used as salaries for suicide bombers and suicide terrorists. Just give us the quick overview, if you would, on that operation.
The name of the guy was a messenger that Hamas sent as a desperate act to get some money into the Gaza Strip. Have to remember that in the time of the war, Hamas was still was supposed to pay money to the militants. All the combatants were relying on Hamas. The families of the combatants were relying on Hamas to give them the food, to give them the money, the services they need, and Hamas ran out of money. Hamas needed to pay millions of dollars to the families in order to continue the fight, and they simply did not have one. So they sent this guy to Egypt to raise some money, and he came with a suitcase full of $13 million in cash. But the Harpoon unit tracked him down, and from the air shot a missile towards his car. All the money were incinerating into the air, and he obviously got killed. That was the blow for the Hamas organization that brought to the end of the war, because they simply could not continue with this cash.
One of the countless very exciting stories and absolutely true stories. And the amazing thing, I must tell you, reading your book, Nitzana, I'm astounded that you were able to tell so many of these stories. I would have thought that Israeli security and military censors, I would have thought that I can hardly believe that so much of this is able to be brought to the public in your incredible book. And I'm very pleased, because it's encouraging for us to see how successfully Israel is prosecuting the war against terror by strangling its money supply. But I'm sure you have many, many, many more stories you cannot tell us, but the ones you can are really good enough. So thanks so much for doing this book. Thank you for being on the show. And anything at all I can do to help you, don't hesitate. I'm happy to do so.
Thank you very much, Rabbi. It really was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Terrific. And we'll say goodbye to Nitzana Darshan-Leitner, the author of Harpoon, Inside the Covert War Against Terrorism's Money Masters. It was published on November the 7th, 2017. So it's brand new. For those of you who are listening to the show live, it's very, very new. And now is the time to head out and get your copy. And I know the book's going to be an incredible hit. So you just watch those numbers drop on Amazon while you order yours. We're going to pause for a moment. The website is rabbidaniellappin.com, and I'll be back with you in just a moment.
Spilling ancient solutions for modern problems in the areas of family, faith, friendship, and finance. This is Rabbi Daniel Lappin, on demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
The Morning Blaze with Doc Thompson.
Bar in Gainesville, Florida had closed, but 27-year-old Casey Wiley wouldn't leave. A bouncer tried to remove her, but she refused to leave. And by refused, I mean she assaulted him with a 12-pack of Pabst Blue Ribbon.
Wow, that is cruel and unusual punishment.
The bouncer didn't want to press charges. She was arrested, though, for disorderly conduct.
Wow. Was she hot?
I don't know. She was 27, so better chance.
The Morning Blaze, weekday morning, 6 to 9 Eastern, on the Blaze Radio Network.
We now return with Rabbi Daniel Lappin on demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
Your rabbi again. And yes, I hope you enjoyed that interview. And again, my apologies. I know the audio on that long distance call wasn't great, but I hope that the material more than made up for it. And I know that if you get a chance to see this book, I think you will be you will find it encouraging, and you'll find it revealing. It'll show you that the good guys sometimes do win. I started off with two anniversaries. It was an anniversary of Kristallnacht, the night in November 1938 when the Nazis made clear that their plan was to terrorize the population, and they really revealed that they were creatures of the left. The other anniversary, of course, was the Bolshevik Revolution. It's 100 years since November 1917, and that was a significant date. It's also 500 years since another very significant date, and that is the start of Protestantism. Martin Luther in Germany in the year 1517. And so that has had an enormous impact on the world. Obviously, I'm not a theologian, I'm not a Christian, and so I'm not going to delve into what the Protestant Revolution meant, what the Reformation meant to the Catholic Church. But as far as the world is concerned, the world has been every bit as much shaped by Protestantism as it had been by Catholicism. And it's rather remarkable when you think about it today. And I'll talk about this a little more down the road, but when you superimpose a map of Africa with Mylars showing pockets of Protestantism, and by the way, Protestantism in Africa, we're not just talking South Africa, Zimbabwe, Zambia, Ghana, Nigeria, Kenya. And in some of these places, we're talking about churches with 20,000 people worshiping. So Protestantism thriving in parts of Africa, and if you superimpose on a map of Africa a Mylar of Protestant revival, along with another Mylar of economic vitality, if you've listened to me for a while, you won't be shocked to hear that those two Mylars correspond. And that pockets of Protestantism, Protestant activism in Africa correspond to those parts of those countries that have been burgeoning
with economic activity. It's very, very interesting, and I have spoken before about the linkage between Protestantism and economic activity. I'm not the first person to think about that. Of course, Max Weber wrote Protestantism and the capitalism and the Protestant work ethic, obviously. So people do understand this topic. It's something that has been discussed. But at any rate, that brings us close to the end of this show for today. I hope you've enjoyed it. If so, please let me know at rabbidaniellappin.com. That's my website, rabbidaniellappin.com. While you're there, make sure you read about an audio program called Clash of Destiny, Decoding the Secrets of Israel and Islam. Following up on the material in the interview I did, I think you'll find that it all comes together and sheds light on what has been going on. So until we are together next week, I am your rabbi, I'm Rabbi Daniel Lappin, wishing you a week of prosperity and good health in the reverse order. God bless.
The Blaze on Demand. This is Rabbi Daniel Lappin.